Hello, I'm Joe Cordell of the domestic litigation firm Cordell & Cordell. Here are a few quick divorce tips that we provide our clients. Number one, don't move out of your house just because your wife tells you to. Remember, that's your house too. And number two, don't blow through the financial statements that you file with the court. These are key exhibits, and they often make or break your case. And number three, watch the social networking. Expect your wife's lawyer to do a thorough online search. And incidentally, this is a two-way street. Now, a bonus tip. Partner with your attorney in assembling evidence. You're one of the two leading experts on your life and marriage. Your attorney needs your input to achieve your goals. And finally, talk to your attorney before taking action. Good luck.
Contact Cordell & Cordell to schedule an appointment with one of our firm's San Francisco area attorneys. A partner men can count on. Online at CordellCordell.com. Offices in San Francisco, San Mateo, and San Jose. Se habla español. Legal services available in English and Spanish. Kimberly Llewellyn, licensed in California.
This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon, my name is Daryl Ong, and you're tuned in to the show that brings you closer to the people and places of our capital city. Earlier this year, contractors from the River of Life project discovered gravestones while digging around the Masjid Jamik area, gravestones that are possibly from the early 18th century. Around 45 of them were found, with most of them made out of granite, and with the knowledge of the area's history being fairly limited, another piece of the puzzle has been found in that it was a Malay graveyard 200 years ago. In the 18th century, the Masjid Jamik area was buzzing with tin mining as well as being the focus of commercial activity. Now the area has a status as a National Heritage Site, but what do the discovery of these tombstones mean and how do we go around to protect artifacts of our national history? Mariana Issa from the Heritage Output Lab and also co-author of the book Kuala Lumpur Street Names joins us along Dato Haji Hajidah Majid, who's the chairman of the International Council on Monuments and Sites Malaysia and the National Heritage Council. Like I said, most of them were made out of granite, but one of them was in marble. Clear difference there, so I wondered, what is the significance of this marble tombstone?
It's really grand, it's really unique.
And it's flat.
Yes, and it's flat. So it's
and therefore, it is a lady.
Yes.
Of some stature, because it's distinguished from the rest, which were done in granite. Mm-hmm. And I think when it was discovered, the tombstones were already stacked there. They were not directly above the burial ground. Mm-hmm. It's just stacked for storage, and then it got covered. And then now when they do a bit of digging, and they discovered this. But obviously, the rest of the tombstones, we were later informed, were taken away from the site or kindly put as stolen from the site, because granite is quite a useful material for use as batu giling and things like that. Eh?
The discovery of these tombstones confirmed early data in regards to the settlement of the communities of the area.
The fact that it is found in the area supports the other evidence and record of the earliest settlement in that area. And there were two masjids within that vicinity of Jalan Jawa, Jawa Street, and which is now Jalan Tun Perak. Mm. So one on either side. So one was frequented by the Minangkabau community and the other mainly the Javanese and others, Rawa and the other sects of the Malay community or the then Pendatang.
While the tombstones served as another piece of evidence of our historical development, it also gives us a deeper understanding into the history of the place and its early cultural habits. However, I wondered about the significance of a cemetery near a mosque.
As the practice then, the nearest location for burial is always near the mosque, because it is a reminder of our transitional life on Earth, that ultimately we will end up in the graveyard, and that in the Alam Barzakh, which is within this. So visitors to the mosque for prayers will often make reference to the fact that so-and-so is buried there and all that. So that is part of the social structure and social values, that traditional values that were practiced, which is still practiced today, but perhaps less understood. So in discovering this Batu Nisan and getting the Masjid Jami to display it within the compound of the now the present masjid will give the necessary information and context of the founding of KL, because the founding of KL is often referred to as at the confluence of the two rivers of Sungai Gombak and Sungai Klang. We have some maps from as early as 1870, and I thought there was another one earlier than that.
That's
the earliest, where it says that the confluence of the two rivers was noted as Malay burial ground. It doesn't talk about Muslim, but Malay refers to Muslim. It's just a quick reference. Across the river is Kampung Rawa, and just to the north of it, we believe was the original settlement of the Minangkabaus, who were in the Malay Street area, or what is now the Masjid India area. Yeah. So, common burials were made at this particular burial ground simply because there is a community there that will take care of the rituals of burial, as well as ziarah, visiting the cemetery from time to time by the relatives and all that. But from the evidence of the few tombstones that were discovered, they were basically ordinary people. And they were perhaps traders, explorers, or just visitors even to Kuala Lumpur then.
The tombstones look fairly regular, but there were a few distinguished people that were buried in that graveyard.
Within the burial ground, there is evidence to say that there were some ornate burial grounds, which could have been made for some of the more dignified people or of a higher social standing.
Like the marble one, is that?
Yes, the marble is one. And then evidence from a photograph of about 1900, taken from, we believe, across Sungai Gombak, you can see the evidence of tombstones being erected above the burial ground. And the river was fully utilized for all activities, including bathing the cows.
They say that these cows are no longer exist, this breed.
And this came from a university in Leiden in Holland, this particular photograph. But it is very apparent that that is the graveyard, and later a mosque, the present Masjid Jami, was built there. And then you have a record in 1910 where it shows some fenced-in graves that looks like a mausoleum kind of thing, but it's not a building, but it is can be treated as if it's part of
Because sometimes they bury the family in one.
Yes.
Compound.
That concept seems to have been carried across to the Jalan Ampang Cemetery, for example. Yeah?
In a quote from the Masjid Jamik Head Administrator Ustaz Faizal Tan Muttalib, he said that there were expectations that some of the remnants of the now shifted graveyard will pop up with a matter of time. But what is the clue to deciphering these tombstones?
The clue to these tombstones is found in the inscription.
Yeah. All the others does not have
inscriptions.
Inscriptions. It's a common gravestone typology
yes.
for that period. In fact, we looked at some photos of the Singapore's old cemeteries, the photos. They look similar.
Yeah.
But two had epigraphies, and we got some help reading.
Yeah.
Had some help. A friend of ours contacted a friend in Cairo. And then we spent like a few days trying to read Jawi. And so the first one, and you can see that the design's a bit different. And it is marked 1309, Sana.
Mm.
Sana is, it means tahun. Pada satu Syawal malam Isnin, Said Abdullah bin Said Abbas Aidid.
Mm.
And so we know the year because 1309 on that date is actually 29th April 1892.
The tombstones date back 200 years, and I wondered if that was the design style of that time.
Different styles. So I think it's based, I mean, Said Abdullah obviously has Arab blood, so the Batu Nisan has some influence from there. And then the others looked like a bit more Indian influence. And then that would make sense because the Jalan Masjid India
yes.
area had some kind of Muslims.
The Ubaidullah family, for example, the Indian Muslims were there also. And in fact, one of the sons, Hisham, is in the committee of the Masjid.
Masjid Jami.
So I met him the other day during the conference. He was parking his car there. I said, why do you park? Oh, I'm in the committee. Okay.
So he gets to park inside. Yeah.
But he lives around here in Bangsa and attends Masjid Bangsa. So I know that fact. I know the late father, and he was the chairman of the Masjid India, the president Masjid India in the Kawasan Masjid India. So
Said Aidid, this family is still around because there's
yes.
The Said Aidid family in Penang is really prominent.
Yes.
And
You see, then there is the other thing about reading tombstones is that unlike the Western society, the surname is retained throughout. Generation after generation, if you are a Roberts, you always remain a Robert. Either you are John Wells Roberts or Wells James Robert. But in our Islamic and Malay community, you are so-and-so, the son of so-and-so. Then when you have your son, he is so-and-so, Ibni yourself. Then your grandfather's name is, his grandfather's name is dropped. So this is why it is important that we should inculcate a sense of awareness and interest in looking at the Batu Nisan and finding out who the families are. So for example, in this case, if we can highlight just this name of Said Abdullah bin Said Aidid.
Said Abbas.
Said Abbas Aidid. Then there might be the third, or no, it could be at least the fifth generation that will say, yes, our great-great-great-great-grandfather was this person. And then they'll be able to tell you their story and their roots. And this is why what makes it interesting. You have a sense of belonging, not only physical to the evidence of the Batu Nisan, but also to your origins and roots.
The tombstones give us a name, but is there any way to find out through 200-year-old records and documents on who this person was? Apparently not. Not for now, at least.
I'm curious.
Yeah.
Yeah. We are curious to know who. So he could be a trader. He could have been a preacher. A pendakwah, if indeed he came as a pendakwah. So all this is not known. It's just speculative until someone can come up and confirm. And they must confirm it with other evidence. For example, mm-hmm. you know, my reference to my grandfather, no, my great-grandfather, Sheikh Abdul Karim, I have a copy of a land title that had his name on. And then it supports. Otherwise, it's only hearsay. Oh, yes, he keturunan baik-baik. You know, people will say that. But the idea is not that. The idea is to respect this system. Because the land is what do you call it? Exhuming of graves is quite common now, especially in countries like Singapore, for example. Singapore has exhumed most of its graves, and especially the Chinese cemeteries, they are big. If you were big in life, your grave should be equally big or correspondingly large to accommodate the descendants to come and pray and things like that. Whereas in the Muslim context, after a person is buried, he can be buried anywhere, even at sea, you know, and in the desert. King Faisal was buried in the desert in an unmarked grave. Nobody knows where exactly. It depends on how you interpret life and afterlife. So some want to have a makam and come and overdo. Of course, some religious scholars will tell you, you don't need to burden the grave with marble slabs and things like that. Yeah. Should be just ordinary grave. And maybe just a marker to say that, yes, here underneath lies so-and-so. And I thought the most fundamental distinction of the tombstone is the shape of the tombstone. If it is cylindrical or round, it's a male burial ground. Female is flat.
Design.
And of course, looking at the maps and the location of some of these graves and the makam, they were not organized then with respect to the direction of Qibla. No, because
they couldn't tell the exact.
So they just pick any spot that's available. So that's why they're not aligned. If you go to Kiara Muslim Cemetery, you will see they're all pre-aligned and they've given lots. So when a grave is dug and a body is buried, then they'll take that, what they call lot number, and assign it to that name person. And then later, they will put the name person on it. And today, for expediency and practical, they do not bury immediately. They do not use each burial lot. They will skip two, dig the third one. So that during burial, there is room around it. You can do the talqin, the last rites. Some burial grounds are still being compacted naturally.
Yeah.
You know, as the body disintegrate. I just read somewhere what happens on the first day, second day, third day, and all that. Quite frightening, but that is reality. You have to face it. There have been stories about graves sinking. That's what they say. But actually, it's the collapse of the support. And when the corpse was laid, then when it's disintegrate, then the earth above it will collapse. So that's why there is the ritual of waiting for about 100 days, which is about 3 months, or 40 days. Sometimes they say within 40 days, the ground will be compacted. Then you can build the final grave.
Coming up, we talk abandoned cemeteries, the significance of these tombstones, and what can be done to preserve our national heritage and history. Stay tuned, my name's Daryl Ong, this is I Love KL, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, my name is Daryl Ong, and welcome to I Love KL, the show that brings you closer to the people and places of our capital city. Today on the show, we're talking about the discovery of 18th century tombstones at a construction site around Masjid Jamik and the significance and possible impact of these pieces of historical evidence. This old cemetery was relocated to Jalan Ampang in phases dating from the late 1900s to the 70s. The old site though was abandoned and was essentially used as a dumping ground. Here's Mariana Issa from the Heritage Output Lab with Dato Haji Hajida Majid, who's the chairman of the National Heritage Council.
There is a record from the municipality that said that after some time, when they opened the cemetery in Jalan Ampang, this cemetery in KL was not used. As such that they were using it as a
workyard
and dumping ground for some leaves and things like that. So it was quite unkempt.
The problems we face in preserving our national history and heritage were similarly faced by the early settlers of the 1900s.
The graveyards were there first. The burial ground was always there. And then in 1893, about 2.25 acres were gazetted as the Malay burial ground.
Yes.
But then eventually, throughout the years, in 1904, 1907, 1915...
They keep on taking...
Yeah, they keep on taking parts of the cemetery.
Kept on eating.
Yes.
Yes.
So that's what I meant by what's new. So
because they were building all these new government buildings, so they wanted
the court
space.
Was there,
yeah.
The survey.
The survey office,
was there.
Town hall. I think I could read out the minutes.
Yeah, you read the minutes. It's quite interesting.
Yes. Okay. So there was a note for the British resident. This was dated 7th of December 1912. It said, "Please point out that the contractor for the new Supreme Court has encroached on the Malay cemetery, at that the graves are in danger of being damaged, and that a fence or hoarding may be put up to shut off the cemetery." Then there was a few replies, but can't read all because the cursives are too personal. But then he said, "Okay, the road referred to in the residence minutes of 18th October 1911 is on the portion of the Malay cemetery adjoining the new buildings, and certain graves will have to be leveled. I spoke to Raja Mahmud, who is one of the cemetery's trustees, about this when the question of the site was under discussion. He told me there would be no objection to making the road. The graves were there of unknown people, and so long as the bones are not disturbed, it did not matter. In view of this, it hardly seems necessary to erect a hoarding, as the road will be made next year." That was on the 10th of December 1912. And then it continued, say, "Please take action." And then he said, "Then this limit of the road had better be defined now, and the graves leveled and some sort of order established in the cemetery. At present, it seems to be used by the contractor as a workyard." And then another reply, "Well, the stacks of timber and two bunk cells near the mosque do not belong to the contractor for the courts. They belong to the contractor for the town hall extension, who is working under the Selangor PWD. I think the resident refers to these in the last sentence of his minute." And said, basically said, "Contractor, please take necessary action to avoid encroachment, to keep the cemetery reserves, and the sheds will be removed."
Malaysia is a large producer of marble with huge quantities all over the country. I'm just wondering, is that somewhat of a clue to that marble tombstone?
I think the marble was brought in. Marble is relatively new. It could have come from Langkawi or so. Marble could have been materials already imported, lying around. But because it's so special, just like...
50 mm.
Yeah, I know. just like Shah Jahan.
Yes.
For Mumtaz, wanted a white marble mausoleum for her that became Taj Mahal. So from his prison... They put him in seclusion, and they put him in the prison. From the upper towers of the room, he can see through the slit. That's Mumtaz punya mausoleum. And if you look on this side, he intends to build a black mausoleum for himself. So This is the kind of information that creates interest in people wanting to come. And this is what I meant to you. I said, okay, since she has initiated this and she spoke to me, I said, okay, good. Don't lose this. Whatever it is, just leave it there. And leave it in this area. When the tourists come, this is the mosque. It was started then. We have enough. When we had Ahbab talk, we explained.
Whose property are these tombstones? Their respective families, if it's even possible to get in touch with them, or do these recovered tombstones belong to the city?
For the record, it belongs to the BKL.
We just highlight the fact that you have to preserve this as part of. Otherwise, later, mana evidence that that was a former cemetery? You need this map. Anyone can prepare and all that. Ni ada batu nisan ni. Kalau tak percaya, kali. You might find remnants of the body. Exhumation is quite common.
All the tombstones that have been recovered have been tagged, but what's going to happen to them? Are they bound to be another token museum piece?
You'll have to ask them.
Every time you discover anything on your ground, it is of any historic significance, it does not necessarily belong to you. It belongs to the country and the state. So the state will have to decide. So this is where I am suggesting to you, and perhaps in my next and first meeting this year, I will raise this to suggest to them to quickly look at this. Maybe it's of no significance as pembesar punya kubur, but a record of the original kubur. Okay, you just go to Masjid Kling.
Kapitan Kling.
Kapitan Kling in Melaka. You just go behind the masjid where the mango trees are. What is that? Kubur. And if you ask the occupants of the kubur to speak, they can tell you the history of Melaka. Because they were born there and they lived there and they died there. So they were buried there. And this is how significant these people are. They may not be anything. They may not be MP ke, Wakil Rakyat ke. But you will say, I was the one who did this. Or, I'm the one who cleaned the drain. So while cleaning the drain, I fell into it and I died. I was the one who was running after that beautiful lady. She gave me the eye and I wanted to follow her. Turn out, punya langsui ke. This is imagination.
Stories of Kuala Lumpur.
Of Kuala Lumpur. No, jokes aside. Stories of Kuala Lumpur, I tell you, I will mention name. There was a very senior government servant during my father's time. Without fail, weekend for him is dress-up affair. He would put on his best tie, sometimes bow tie. One of the beginning, BB Park and Lucky World. BB Park, the car, Bukit Bintang. Lucky World, Punggol Rahman. Why? He goes there. He likes to dance. Joget, ronking, cha-cha-cha. He was a nun. Very nice man. Very quiet, mind his own business.
That was his outlet.
His outlet. Mm. He dresses up. Dia pakai kasut, the black and white, where you polish the white, the kapur. Phew. We always to see, and middle parting, Gatsby. There were these people. And then if you look at some of the P. Ramlee, old movies, talk about the same.
Those films were reflecting
today,
yeah.
And those films, that means that kind of thinking was there and that practice. To me, there are some significance to this. May appear intangible, but very tangible in the context of cultural appreciation and richness.
For the people of this generation, we wouldn't have seen the cemetery. And without the discovery of these tombstones, the area's rich history and the fact that there was a cemetery there would be fairly uncovered and relegated to history books and old maps.
We only know that it was a cemetery through the old maps. And then, it's just that something we learn, and there are factual statements on a map about Kuala Lumpur. Okay. But after 124 years, these resurface to remind us that the cemetery was once there. Because kalau tak jumpa ni, like, it'll never, the subject will never.
I would have told you that because it was a cemetery.
Yeah, but we know it was a cemetery, but people who come and...
Moved in 1980s,
1980s and beyond, and then people who are moving into Kuala Lumpur, they wouldn't know.
And they never know if you don't tell them.
Yes.
And you don't display them. They must discover it and then want to know, ni kubur siapa? And then if you can show an image of that person, for example, be fantastic.
That was Mariana Issa from the Heritage Output Lab and also co-author of the book Kuala Lumpur Street Names, which is excellent, you should get it, and also the voice of Dato' Haji Hajidah Majid, who's the chairman of the International Council on Monuments and Sites Malaysia and the National Heritage Council. A big thanks to Nadia Aziz for production help on this week's episode. Sadly, we've come to the end of the show today, but if you'd like to revisit the story, just head over to our website www.bfm.my/ilovekl to download the podcast. Also, if you'd like to get in touch with us, just tweet us. We are at BFM Radio. My name's Daryl Ong. Thanks for listening, and do join us again next week for another exciting episode of I Love KL, only here on BFM 89.9, the business station.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hello, I'm Joe Cordell of the domestic litigation firm Cordell & Cordell. Here are a few quick divorce tips that we provide our clients. Number one, don't move out of your house just because your wife tells you to. Remember, that's your house too. And number two, don't blow through the financial statements that you file with the court. These are key exhibits, and they often make or break your case. And number three, watch the social networking. Expect your wife's lawyer to do a thorough online search. And incidentally, this is a two-way street. Now, a bonus tip. Partner with your attorney in assembling evidence. You're one of the two leading experts on your life and marriage. Your attorney needs your input to achieve your goals. And finally, talk to your attorney before taking action. Good luck.
Contact Cordell & Cordell to schedule an appointment with one of our firm's San Francisco area attorneys. A partner men can count on. Online at CordellCordell.com. Offices in San Francisco, San Mateo, and San Jose. Se habla español. Legal services available in English and Spanish. Kimberly Llewellyn, licensed in California.